The next session is about you. You'll be delighted to hear. So this is more to do with how does this apply to me? What does it feel like to do a project like this? And what can I take from what we've just heard and what we're about to hear and use this in my organisation? Now, I know we have a number of different kinds of organisations. We have museums, public libraries, consultants, account managers from other information providers. So, forgive me while I generalise for a second. So, you'll remember earlier on that we talked about archiving. Bringing data to life and all that that means. So what does that mean? So from your point of view, you will have some unique motivations, some unique things that are driving you to worry about your data. And it is about worry, actually, in many ways. So what are the reasons why you're feeling that you need to preserve and archive your data? Is it about protecting these precious assets? These are rhetorical questions, because I'm sure the answer is actually yes to everything, as I mentioned. But it's worth thinking about it, I should say, in the context of being able to explain this internally. So from a business case point of view, from an internal report to your directors to say, this is important. Why do we have to do this? Here are my reasons. Here are why it's important to us right here, right now. So there are a mixture of things in the business case, and we've actually provided written an ebook on exactly this subject, on the subject of making your case for preservation. Because as we've already heard today, there's not a lot of existing practice out there yet. Not when you compare it to library management systems or information library systems. So you will probably firstly be in a position having to make an argument for why this is even important, as we were saying earlier, why a backup isn't good enough, those sorts of arguments. So are you looking to protect your assets? Is it that you need to make sure that the public see more of what you've got? Or, and I'm being very general because we have lots of organisations here, or is it that you want to make your precious resources available to specialist researchers or on an international scale, or those sorts of motivations? So do you need to actually increase your profile of your organisation? And access and reputation usually go together. Is part of the motivation for making things archive for the long term, preserving things for decades to come, is that important for your own institutional reputation? Could you actually step out onto a bigger stage, metaphorically, if you as an organisation were able to say, we have this really precious thing, this collection, this whatever it is, and people should know about it? Stepping on from that again, is part of that reason to actually make some money out of this thing, to actually allow people to download for a fee or come and access it in a particular way. There'll be lots of different ways, you know, order prints, you know, copies of the picture of the castle or whatever it is. And in a public library context, that can be really important. We've certainly seen that in the UK, for example. Is part of the reason why you need to do this to actually free up some time for staff? Do you need to automate these processes more easily because you can't afford the resources you have, or you know that you need to do more with this data and you don't have the ability to add 5 extra people to your team? Wouldn't that be lovely? But that's not very likely, I don't think, unless you're going to tell me otherwise. So how do I do all these big things, these new things, because these are all relatively new processes that we're talking about for most of you. How do I realistically do that without adding 5 members of staff to my team? Because that's not possible. And so, again, from a technology point of view, we take it as our responsibility to address some of these motivations, to be able to say, actually, we can do all these cool things, which Sinead will show you, and it needn't necessarily be very heavy on staff. So we're trying to get that balance between control and configurability and flexibility and resource management, people management, so we can do it that way. It's probably a mixture of everything. It's probably all of those things. But again, talking a little bit about the project and why, the whys and the reasons behind it, these are an important place to start internally if you're trying to get support for this idea of, look, we need to start preserving all of this stuff that we've digitized. We've spent all this money on digitizing our collection. And I can quote from a heritage organization in the UK. They have hard drives of data on the shelf behind them. And they say, look, it's preserved. There it is. Isn't that great? And yes, that is great. But only to a point, of course. It only goes so far. And having extra copies and being able to digitize something is fantastic. And it's the first step, of course it is. But it's not going to be enough. And very quickly, you may find that the investment that you've made, for example, in digitizing these collections could be lost or partially corrupted if you're not looking after that digital result of these digitization projects. And of course, as we've heard already from Miklos, the volume and the diversity of the born digital data is almost impossible to understand, humanly understand. So we understand the problem there. So if we are doing a project then, seriously, where do we start? And we can try and give you some help, some guidance, some examples of where other people have started and what we're doing here at the National Library, of course. It starts with some very simple questions, like most projects, I suppose. What is worrying me the most? What is making me not sleep very well at night? And that's a great place to start. So what sort of data types do you have? What file formats are they in? You will know this probably, although as Sinead said, sometimes people don't. Sometimes the biggest problem is, I have no idea what we have. Or I know what I have, I don't know what the rest of the organization has that they're supposed to give to me, but they haven't. And we find this a lot in research, in academia, for example. So try to get a handle somehow on what you might have. And you will be at different levels of maturity in that journey of understanding what you have. And also remembering, of course, that digital preservation we're talking about today. But we are also talking about what you need to provision for 5 years' time or 10 years' time. And that's almost impossible to predict. So to have an idea of what sorts of files or what sorts of departments or locations you might have in the future, or at least providing a level of flexibility in your resources and your IT solutions to cope with the most likely situations in the future. As I mentioned earlier, that's kind of the best that we can hope for. And again, the mixture between digitized and born digital or digital native items and trying to understand exactly what the difference is for you in between your organization is going to be really important. So what does it actually involve then? Well, again, it always, at this stage in the maturity of digital data archiving, in the industry that we are in, it almost always starts with this business case, with making an argument internally within your organization to say, I need time, I need resources, I need project scope for doing something bigger and better with our digital data collection. Assuming that goes really easily, and that could be a year in itself, and we're very used to people taking a long time to get past that point, but assuming that you have, we then start to talk about scope and planning. So very traditional, any project will obviously start there. But From a preservation point of view, as I say, we start to ask these specific questions about your collection, because that helps people like us, like Archivum and EBSCO, to actually predict and plan your ingest needs, your egress needs. How much of your collection, do you know the answer to this question? How much of your collection will you need back at any point? Nobody can answer that. So you have to predict what your usage might be like, and again, build in flexibility in case that perhaps and certainly will change. Make sure that you obviously provide a layer of project management. And for us, for Archivum, for preservation projects, that project management very heavily includes things like integration, includes things like making sure that the data is ingesting correctly from several different places, it's being spat out into several different places. And for example, here we're talking about a number of different institutions, so you've got a lot of input strands as well. So it's a complicated set of requirements, potentially. User acceptance testing, of course. We actually help people with these test scenarios because, again, people won't have a back catalogue of preservation test scenarios that they've used on the systems that they've bought before. So we will actually provide that to people and make sure that they are sort of helped through the process whilst also adding in, obviously, your own requirements. And go live as well. Go live in as much as go live with phase one, usually. Because, again, with many IT systems, but particularly for data archiving, it's usually a very good idea to phase the approach because you will have an iterative or an evolving need. So we're very used to being able to do that. And of course, usually project plans end at go live. Hurrah! We're done. But of course, that's obviously the start. That's actually the start of the whole thing, of course, isn't it? So we have a whole process within Archivum, certainly, to do with customer success, ongoing management. These changes that happen very specifically in data archiving that say, we have suddenly had approval for a massive digitization project. What we thought was going to happen for the next 3 years, forget it, it's all changed. So it's the ability to be able to live with those sorts of requirements as well. As you will have seen, no digital preservation event is complete without a big picture of the OAIS model, so the Open Archival Information System, as you've seen. But it is worth bearing in mind that actually this kind of left-to-right process of moving data through a number of workflows is really important. And actually, any system that you're looking to implement, either yourselves or with Archivum or whomever, needs to follow basically this exact path in technical terms. But what's really valuable from our point of view is that our process doesn't start on the left and finish on the right, and it doesn't have a sort of a channel view. So it's not boxed in as this tends to let you think that it would be. What we've managed to do, as Sinead will show you, is to make all this happen, I hasten to say automatically, because that's not quite right, because as I say, you would have control over what happens, but we're making this happen underneath the surface, the sort of the idea of the swan swimming on the water. This is the underwater shot, or the iceberg underneath, as Miklos was showing. And so that's the difference, that's the value with us, I think, is that we're actually providing a platform that does all of this stuff that you would imagine. It ticks all of the correct boxes, but actually we're a level above that. We're providing a management layer that gives you comfort that actually what you've got is even easier to administer than these many microservice processes will allow you to sort of get lost into if you need to. So briefly then, before we get into the good stuff, which is to actually see some of the views of the solution and how people are actually using it, I wanted to pull out some unique differentiators, and I've tried to keep them as succinct as I ever am. So again, pulling on this point of making it easy to use, we're all different degrees of experts in this room, but we still love Google. we still order things off easy-to-use websites because they're easy to use. So there's a huge inherent human nature to make things simple, even though they're very complicated. That's how Apple has survived for so long, I'm sure. So that's the basic premise, and preservation is no different, although slightly less ubiquitous than Apple. I'm just suggesting. So we have a partner focus. Obviously, part of the reason why we're all here today is because EBSCO and Archivum are working so closely together here at the National Library, and we're really focused on that in a way that makes us unique, because we're entirely flexible with what we're doing, and equally, we are built on open standards. So we use Archivematica, we use Atom, and the other artifactual released solutions. They power a lot of what we do, but as I say, what we're able to do is build this ecosystem around these open tools. So hopefully you get the best of both worlds. You get as open a system as you can possibly handle, because we know that the IT systems have to last decades and decades. But you also have the comfort of a managed service, of a support team, of the ability for us to develop it so that you don't have to hire developers to support this open source thing. That's absolutely not the case. So hopefully we're giving you the best of everything, as I say, with the fully managed service. Being able to say that we provide a 100% data integrity guarantee is really important to Archivum. And we do that by providing multiple copies and escrow copies of the data, and lots of things that run in the background and keep, you know, sort of probably about half of the Archivum staff busy every day, just keeping the data alive. We don't throw it in a room and lock it and throw away the key. We proactively manage the media it's stored on, the file formats that it's saved in, all of these activities that allow us to be able to say this very quick thing of 100% data integrity guarantee. Any other sort of service would give you 99.9 or something like that, which for archive material just isn't really good enough, we don't think. So that's why we provide that. Integration, I've mentioned, we're very, very, very tight on integration. And again, Sinead, from a technical perspective, can explain the hows and the whys. But again, a nice open suite of APIs means that we haven't come across yet, I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, a system that we can't integrate with. It shouldn't be that the answer is no to any of the questions that you give us to do with the systems that you already have. Exit plan is a really interesting one. It's another unique thing to Archivum, and it's weird to be talking about an exit plan, you know, at the very beginning of any project, but we do. And actually, it's vital, because as we mentioned, you need to have the comfort that you can get to that data at any point, because it's always yours. We're just looking after it for you. So you have the ability to remove yourself from these processes as and when you need to. There's no lock-in. There's no sort of black box scenario where you have no idea what's happening with your data. So as I say, best of both worlds. And something that I really love, something that sort of gets me out of bed in the morning, the reason why I really love working at Archivum is because we understand the community. We spend a lot of time and effort making sure that we come and speak to people in our respective markets and understand, okay, so what's new? What's vexing you at this stage? GDPR was a tiny example of that. And we take a lot of time to make sure that we understand what's going on in the market, as I say, including events like this. So that's a really valuable part of what we do. Two other examples before I hand over to Sinead. We work with Tate Britain in London. And they have trying to give you some examples of, okay, well, yeah, who's doing it? And what are the different deployment models or options here? So Tate have three locations on site, so very similar to what we expect to be doing here, so within the organisation itself. And they're safeguarding thousands and thousands of artworks in that way. So that's one example. And another one that I wanted to show you was the Irish Traditional Music Archive, or ITMA, based in Dublin in Ireland. That's fully hosted. So the other end of that particular example, they don't have a lot of IT support or resources. There's not a lot of archive staff in themselves. They're quite a small organization. They have about 17 terabytes of data that's very precious, you know, recordings of traditional music performances in Irish pubs and that sort of thing that they can't afford to lose. But they don't have a lot of time or resources or people. So they've got a fully hosted service that we manage on their behalf. So I just wanted to give you those two examples to start to make it more real about what people are actually doing and give you the ideas of where this works.
We still have some time to ask any question what arises from today's presentations.
If I remember well, on your slide, there was an interesting bullet point when you were talking about the ITMA, Irish Music Archive. It said intuitive search mechanism. What do you mean?
So we mean the ability to search across an entire collection, very much like Sinead was talking about, from the archivist point of view, which is intuitive and easy. So dare I say it, a Google-type experience, meaning you don't have to be an expert to search. I'm a librarian, but I know what a Boolean operator is, but most people don't, because they have a life. So it needs to be easy. So there's that side of it, but also from the customer end, the search end, and whether that's Folio, EDS or Viewfind or Atom, which is what powers our search interface, it should be very easy to discover what you have. And then based on your access rights, depending on what they are, it will then allow you to discover that item, whether it's just the small, low-resolution thumbnail version of the thing, or whether you're allowed to download the full rich record. So it should be nice and straightforward. You shouldn't have to be taught how to use the search interface specifically. I think that's all I meant, which was important for ITMA because they don't have a lot of time or resources or staff. So that's why that was on there.